The Minnesota House of Committee on Elections is called to order. I'm Representative Dean, chair of the committee. This is our first virtually conducted hearing of this committee, so I ask the members of the public's patience as we are in the process of learning how to use both technology to conduct these hearings in a manner and a process that accompanies it in order to engage in good, transparent legislative deliberations. Please know that this hearing is being recorded and will be available on the committee's webpage on the Minnesota House website, as well as it's currently available on live stream. So while we're conducting this discussion via video platform using the proprietary Zoom technology instrument, the hearing itself is available for live viewing by visiting the Minnesota House live stream links on the website and also on Facebook. These links can be found on the Elections Committee page also. Citizens have signed up prior to the hearing. If others in the public wish to offer comments, and if time permits, which I would just say we're not likely to actually going to have time for public who didn't sign up in advance, but please feel free to email the committee administrator, Amanda Rudolph, and her email address is amanda.rudolph@house.mn. Committee members are either participating by video or by audio only, depending on their local broadband access. And a reminder to members to be sure to click on the participant button on the Zoom dashboard at the bottom, and that should launch a side window that will allow you to virtually raise your hand so that you can be recognized for questions and comments. I've organized today's meeting around two sort of broad themes to structural response to the COVID-19 pandemic crisis that we have. One is to address how to conduct the elections in Minnesota during this unprecedented time. And the other is addressing the matching funds, HAVA funds from the federal government so that they can be released to the Secretary of State for use. We're gonna hear testimony from the Secretary of State, Steve Simon, and representatives from organizations engaged and concerned about elections. We will give the Secretary of State 10 minutes followed by question and answer from members for about 15 minutes, during which time we'll hear amendment language related to issues from these members. We'll then move on to testimony of those who have requested to testify during today's hearings, and I would like them to limit their comments to 5 minutes. And just so folks know that although we'll have some official business and that will be approving the meeting minutes, we'll also do a roll call for members. The bills that we will be talking today are just in draft form, so we will not be taking any action on the bills other than having the discussion regarding them. I'm sure that Secretary of State will speak to some of the issues regarding our current state, where we're at, some of the proposals that have been discussed and move forward, and then we'll talk specifically about some of the issues relative to the bills. I hope that everybody has gotten a copy of the agenda and that you have that in front of you, and we'll be referencing that as we speak and move forward. So I say that, and I currently don't have my agenda up. So what I'd like to do is now open up the mic for the committee legislative assistants to take roll call. So Ms. Vang, if you could go through and take roll call, that would be great.
Representative Dean.
Present.
Representative Bonner.
We need to unmute members.
Representative Bonner?
Present.
Representative Nash?
Present.
Representative Bernardi?
Present.
Representative Halverson?
Present.
Representative Mann?
Present.
Representative New?
Did we lose Representative New?
I believe she's still not here. She had sent a message that she'll be late.
I saw her earlier. Is she in the waiting room, Amanda?
No, she's not.
Okay, well, hopefully she will join us back in a moment. We do have a quorum present.
We have not called for Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh. Yingya?
Representative O'Driscoll?
Present from StarTel.
Okay.
How many members are present, Yingya?
7 out of 8.
Okay, so we have a quorum, members. We are officially in business. I believe the minutes of, was it March 4th, have been sent out. Have folks, anybody had a chance to review them and would like to move the approval of the minutes?
Move the approval of the minutes, Nash.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nash. I see that Representative New has now joined us again. Ms. Vang, if you could please take a roll call of the approval of the March 4th minutes.
Chair Dean?
Yeah, let's get rid of Representative Lesh there. yes.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Representative Halverson?
Aye.
Representative Mann?
Aye.
Representative New?
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Aye.
8, all 8 representatives said yes.
Okay, minutes have been approved. So what we're going to be doing is beginning to talk about the current language that's out there. We have two other members that have joined us, Representative Nelson and Representative Albright. Chair Nelson from the State Government Finance Committee will be speaking a bit about the HAVA provision in the bill. And Representative Albright is joining us as I believe he's part of the Secretary of State's task force that's beginning to look at elections. So I want to thank both of you for joining us today. And with that, Amanda, if you would like to welcome the Secretary of State into our Zoom call, and we can begin his testimony regarding the current proposed language related to the upcoming election.
Hello?
Yes, Mr. Secretary, welcome to the committee. Again, please state your name for the record and go ahead and proceed.
Great. Mr. Chair, can everyone see and hear me? Okay, great. Thank you, members. Hello from Hopkins, Minnesota. I'm doing the best here with my background. You can see my 7-year-old daughter's scarecrow that she made for me. It's kind of lucky. So that's the background. Thank you for having me here today. Members, I think we all share the same goals of ensuring that the 2020 elections allow all eligible Minnesotans to vote safely and enable elections administrators to put on the election smoothly. And I hope we can all rise to the moment, not just in this committee hearing, but for the rest of the legislative session. We need to be proactive. We need to look to solutions that match the scope of the problem. And we need to put politics aside, all of us, me included, everyone. I understand the gut reaction of some people, which is to say, hey, maybe this is a little hasty. Maybe we should sit back and wait. We don't know where we're going to be in August for the state primary. We don't know what the world's going to look like in November for the general election. Why don't we sit back and not do anything yet until we have a better idea of what things are going to be like? So I get that. I absolutely do. It's a natural thing to think. And we don't know what lies ahead. None of us do. But until we're told otherwise, we need to treat the statewide elections in Minnesota as a public health issue. Because if we guess right now, if we guess that the crisis will go past us and that it'll be over by August or that there won't be a wave two in November, and if we guess wrong, we're in for a real disaster of an election season. So we can't just coast and glide on current law and think that's going to do it. We need some one-time emergency changes. And the truth is that planning always starts now in the months of March and April for elections. So training guides are being put together as we speak. Vendors are knocking at our door and on the doors, all your county and city elections administrators asking, what's up? What do we need to do or not do to prepare for the upcoming elections? So this is an immediate issue. We're seeing states around the country respond to the COVID-19 crisis in different ways. I'm sure I don't need to say that much about what happened yesterday in Wisconsin. No matter where you sit or stand politically, it was an ugly scene. Huge lines. Mass exposure to the virus in the polling places, that's the key thing. Abandoned polling places, there were over 180 polling places in Milwaukee. It was down to 5 yesterday, 5 members. That's 10,000 voters per polling place. That's just untenable from a public health standpoint. In the city of Green Bay, 31 polling places down to 3 yesterday. So it was really outrageous and it was avoidable. That's the worst part about it, it was avoidable. So people were forced in Wisconsin to decide between their health and exercising their right to vote. And it's not just Wisconsin. All over the country, voters are very worried. There was a national survey that came out last week, some polling that showed that 66% of Americans, two-thirds, 66% said that they are uncomfortable going into a polling place right now. All over the country, poll workers are quitting. They're just bailing. That's what happened in Milwaukee. That's what happened in Green Bay and all over Wisconsin yesterday. They quit. And you can't run a polling place without poll workers, so they had to massively consolidate. And they're getting sick. There are reports of election judges getting COVID-19 in Michigan, in Florida, and elsewhere. So polling places are being forced to close. And to put it in perspective for Minnesota, as many of you know, it takes 30,000 poll workers to put on an election. 30,000. That is a small army. That's a lot of people. And they tend to skew older, no question about that. And they are therefore in the most vulnerable group of our population. Now, in many states, the Secretary of State or the State Board of Elections, if they have one, they have the authority to open, close, consolidate, or move polling places, or even move to all-mail balloting. We don't have that power in Minnesota. We don't. Things are locked in. And unless we change, no one has that authority right now, absent really extreme circumstances, which don't, at least on the face of it, appear to exist right now. Either way, we need to think about a solution now. And if anyone has doubts about whether or not we need to be discussing this legislation or something like it right now, look no further than the huge message that the federal government sent just 2 weeks ago. In the $2 trillion stimulus package that President Trump signed, that was passed unanimously by the Senate and that passed almost unanimously by the U.S. House, there was $400 million in there for states for the express purpose of COVID-19 election planning. So let me be clear, that money can only be used for that purpose. Not anything else, only for COVID-19 pandemic election planning. So I don't know how the federal government could be any more clear. They're telling all of us, you should be not only thinking about this and acting on it now, but spending money now on making sure that you are ready for a pandemic election situation. So my office has been working closely with our partners, our teammates, because elections are a team sport, election administrators throughout the state who are reasonably concerned about the upcoming elections, and some of them are here with us today. We've had various conversations and recently had a conference call with elections administrators at the city and county level, a broad base, large counties, small counties, metro, non-metro, etc. And we got their thoughts, concerns, and ideas. So the bill in front of you today is a starting place. It is reflective of their concerns and recommendations during these conversations. This is not my office's wish list. This is the actual defined needs and requests of counties and cities across the state. So here are the basics. The bill only applies when a regular or special election is scheduled to be conducted during the period of or immediately following a peacetime emergency declared by the governor that relates to an infectious disease outbreak endangering public health. So assuming, as I think we all are, that this will be over next year, this will not under any circumstances, barring another pandemic, carry over. The whole idea here is that we snap back to regular law when this is over. So this is a one-time deal. That's very clear right in the bill. Secondly, it requires our office to consult with impacted local election officials prior to issuing any sort of direction or order. So this isn't a unilateral decision of anyone. So it's only during a peacetime emergency that our office would be able to do the following. First, conduct the election substantially by mail. We already have a provision in law under 204B.456. And let me really emphasize this, because this is an important point. 130,000 Minnesotans, including constituents of people on this committee, 130,000 Minnesotans already live under this system. It's a system that is enjoyed in five other states, Washington State, Oregon, Utah, Hawaii, and others, Colorado, and 130,000 Minnesotans, one quarter of all of our precincts, 130,000 already live under the system right now. They get a ballot automatically in the mail every election. Doesn't matter whether it's a general, a primary, a special. They don't have to apply. They don't have to ask. They don't have to think about it. They get it in the mail right now. 130,000 Minnesotans and growing. Many jurisdictions, you know, we have this law in Minnesota. If you are a city of 400 or fewer registered voters, or a township of any size outside the metro, you have the option and have had since 1987 to choose that option. So this is just expanding statewide what we already have for 130,000 people in Minnesota. It would also give our office the ability to close, consolidate, or relocate high-risk polling places. We have 43 polling places in Minnesota that are in senior high-rises or nursing homes or senior and assisted care facilities. For all the obvious reasons, we need to get them out of there now, immediately. But we don't have the authority to do that right now. This bill would also give more time for local administrators to process the mail ballots. This is a key thing I think you're gonna hear about from some of the testifiers today. From an actual logistical standpoint, you cannot move people away from polling places and the numbers we need to keep people safe and not change some of the deadlines to make sure counties can handle the influx of mail. This also would allow nominating petitions to be signed electronically so that candidates and their supporters don't have to risk their health or lives going door to door. Some of the non-major parties have brought this to our attention. I can't imagine in good conscience any of us wanting to make the Green Party or make the Libertarian Party at a time like this go door to door to get signatures. They can do it electronically. Michigan and other states have already led the way in moving towards this for those who need signatures to get ballot access. It would allow our office or local administrators to train and designate employees of healthcare facilities to administer absentee voting. Right now, folks in the counties and cities already do this work. They go into those facilities and facilitate absentee balloting, but for all the obvious reasons, we don't want outsiders going into nursing homes. We don't want outsiders going into senior and assisted care facilities. So training and deputizing folks who already work there to do that work, which is already in statute. And finally, as you'll hear from others later about, it authorizes the use of the HABA funds. It's $6.9 million. This is the third batch of HABA funds for those who are following at home. The first batch, after a year delay, we finally got that. The second batch, which was provided by Congress for election security last December, is still in limbo in the legislature. The third batch was the stimulus money only for COVID-19 planning. So this would provide access to those funds. Members, just to put things in perspective, we are expecting at least 3 million polling place voters this year. It's not counting the 130,000 that already live under a situation where they get it back by mail. We are very likely to have over 3 million that are actually voting in polling places. So the math is pretty easy. We have about 3,000 polling places. I'm rounding just a little bit. So about 3 million voters, 3,000 polling places. That is a rough average of 1,000 voters per polling place. Now, as you know from your own districts, sometimes it's quite a bit smaller than that, but sometimes it's quite a bit bigger. But the rough average statewide is 1,000 people per polling place. That is way, way too high. 1,000 people and their droplets circulating in often close quarters over a narrow 13-hour period. Can you blame voters for telling pollsters that they are uncomfortable setting foot in that situation? Can you blame election judges for wanting to bail and leave that job often on short notice or no notice? Would you advise anyone you know or love to do that job? It's not their job. They get paid for it. It's a one-day, one-time gig. Would you advise anyone in your life, a son, a daughter, a parent, to do that job? I think you'd probably question yourself, or you'd at least take a moment before you advise someone to do that job. So people shouldn't have to choose between their health and their right to vote, especially when Minnesota is in a position to plan for the situation ahead of time. Again, we need to minimize exposure at polling places and maximize vote by mail. And that's not just what I say or county elections administrators say or city folks say. It's what the CDC says. We can get you the information. It's on their website. They have come out with guidance that is election specific. And if I had to summarize it in a phrase, their guidance is please stay away from polling places to the extent you can and that your state laws allow. Don't go to polling places. And we can spend some of this money on hand sanitizers and wiping down tables and all the rest. And that might, at the margins, help people feel a little more comfortable. It might make me feel a little more comfortable. But I don't think we're kidding anyone that if we spend a bunch of money on hand sanitizers and disposable pens, that people are going to be comfortable en masse to the tune of millions going to polling places. So the best way to do that, I think, to heed the CDC guidance is to send ballots to all registered voters, not eligible voters, those who are already in the system. They've been screened, they've been vetted, they've been filtered. They get the ballots automatically. And this isn't a new concept, as I said, since 1987 and now 130,000 voters. So one more thing I have to say, and then I will turn it over, Mr. Chair. In response to the concerns of COVID-19, I think that the Minnesota House and Senate have really acted responsibly in the last 2 weeks by giving members in an unprecedented way the ability to vote from home, the ability to vote remotely without having to ask, without having to plead or fill out a form. All members on this committee, members of the House and Senate, have been able to vote remotely from their own living rooms. I've seen the Twitter feeds. I've seen the photos of people with their coffee mugs and in their living rooms. And some of them have even called me and brought to my attention that this was happening. And I think that's great. I think that was the right call. But you can understand how it might be reasonable for a Minnesotan to ask if legislators have given themselves the privilege of not commingling with a few dozen colleagues, doesn't it stand to reason? Isn't it reasonable to have a discussion about giving them and making it easier for them to do the same and not have to commingle with maybe not 1,000 people at the same time, but go into a room, often in tight quarters, where 1,000 people and their droplets are lingering over a tight 13-hour period? I think it's a reasonable question. Legislators have rightly enjoyed that privilege. Minnesotans, I think, rightly could ask, why can't we have that privilege, especially when 130,000 of our fellow citizens already enjoy that privilege right now? It's scaling up what we already have on a bigger scale to protect public health. So that's the bottom line. And let me just close with this. I will acknowledge there are parts of this bill, and some of you have been very straightforward, and I appreciate it. You've said from the get-go, there are things in here that you don't like, that you really can't see yourself supporting. And I understand that. There are principled disagreements, and smart and thoughtful people on this committee and elsewhere can really have principled disagreements with parts of this bill or maybe all of the bill. But I would ask you then, please, either now or later, to offer your own plan, because it really is not enough. It will not be enough to just say we can coast and glide on current law. And you'll hear the nitty gritty, maybe, minute details about why that is from an administrative and logistical standpoint. But if we just say current law can handle it, we have no excuses absentee voting, why can't everyone just go online and order the ballot? That isn't going to solve the problem. That could maybe get the ratio down, maybe to 500 per polling place. Someone told me recently that if Minnesota hit a grand slam home run, if we doubled the percentage of those who voted absentee from 24 to 48, even rounded up to 50, that would be a grand slam. That's still 500 people per polling place. So I would love to hear your pushback, your feedback, your criticisms. I'll certainly, you know, we should all work on this together, but it's important that we come up with a plan, and just saying that current law is okay is not a plan in my judgment. So thank you. I'm happy to take any questions or criticisms or suggestions that you have. Thanks very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Simon. Secretary Simon. We're now going to move into Q&A from members. We do have a couple amendments that we will discuss during the Q&A, and maybe we can start with Representative Nelson with the A3 and the A4 amendment. If you could just speak to what those would do, and then we can add the Q&A from members. So Representative Nelson, I believe your mic is off, so go ahead and join us. And,
I just turned it on, yeah. Yep. The A3, I'm just getting my paper here. So I got the right one up here. But the A3, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, the A3 amendment that we got here is came out of the meeting, the conference call with the Secretary of State earlier this week, and with the this came out of what the county officials, the election officials were saying, that if we doubled the amount of voters that do the current absentee ballot, they would have trouble counting those ballots because they were saying a large percentage of them come in the last 2 days. And because of that, the number of that come in, the processing of them, it takes 6 touch points to get them to the point where they actually can feed it in the machine. And then the time it takes to feed it through the machine, that they may have trouble counting all those ballots by the end of election day. And so they were asking that, and their suggestion, and again, this just came out of what they said, was maybe extend the time ahead of the election. They were saying up to 21 days. I put 14 days. I put in the amendment here. And then some time after the election date. And they were saying maybe a week after the election to allow them to make sure that all the absentee ballots that came in were able to get voted or counted on election day. And if we were to switch to all mail-in ballots, this would, again, that would even make it more difficult for them to count them. And so that's what this amendment does. It just extends the period to 2 weeks before the election where they can start running those through the machine and counting them, and then a week after. And on the week after, I'm not, you know, wedded to that time. This is just a suggestion that the election officials had that were on the call.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. If you could just speak briefly then to the A4 amendment.
The A4 amendment is, and this actually is more to help the GOP in our state. Currently, the way the law is about having to get their electors, the names of their electors into the Secretary of State's office, it falls in the middle of their national convention, the current dates for their national convention. So they won't have nominated a presidential candidate yet. Now, we all assume that it's going to be the current president, President Trump's going to be nominated for re-election, but that may or may not be the case. And if in this case here, they would have to submit names of who their electors are before they've selected a candidate. And what this amendment does is just move that back so that it's a time after their convention is over. And so that would give them the time and the Democrats the time to make sure that the people that are chosen as the electors are the ones that are going to vote for the president in the Electoral College.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nelson. I'm going to now speak to the A5 amendment. And for those of you who don't have it in front of you, if you look very quickly at the A5 amendment, it's changing one word, and that word is as I'm trying to pull up my A5 amendment. It changes on line 21, I believe, first page. It deletes the word entirely and inserts primarily. This is in reference to absentee ballots being sent out to all registered voters in the state of Minnesota. And we know that this is something that would be primarily what we're doing, and ultimately that that it's not the entirety of what can be done. There'll be other things done. And I believe that you know, some of our testifiers may speak to that. Actually, I think Ms. Sanders may speak to the issue of in blind individuals in the state of Minnesota and the process in which they will vote. So those are the amendments. I believe we have one hand raised for questions, and that would be Representative O'Driscoll. If you would like to ask your question or make your comment, and I'm going to unmute you. So right now you are unmuted. Please proceed, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is directed towards Secretary Simon. I was wondering if he'd yield the question.
Well, Mr. Secretary Simon.
Yes.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Secretary Simon. One of the concerns that we have and why some of the auditor's offices and some of the things you articulated in your reasoning for why we wouldn't have polling places open, also I think cascade in the U.S. Postal Service. As you may have seen, many postal workers have concerns about their individual health. They also have concerns about perhaps getting hazard pay. You'll notice if you've been at the post office, they've taken some other precautions. What is your plan anticipated for some reason that is declared that the Postal Service is on hiatus and not able to deliver ballots or to return ballots? How are we going to deal with disenfranchised voters when we could have at least had people go to a polling place and cast a physical ballot? And I do have some other follow-up questions, Mr. Chair.
Secretary Simon.
Yes, can you hear me okay? Just want to make
yes.
sure. Okay, thank you, Representative O'Driscoll and members. Great question. First, let me say, if I wasn't clear, that's my failing. We would still have polling places, just not as many. The idea, the way it works in other areas or states that have tried this is you still have the option to go, but it isn't as many. It's far fewer. There are so-called vote centers. So I live in the city of Hopkins, which typically has six precincts, so six polling places. I would imagine in this situation, Hopkins would have one open. Maybe it's just City Hall on Election Day, because after all, only registered voters at the time the mailing goes out would get the mailing. There could be others who have never voted before and register after that. So you have to have some polling place open. But to your point about the U.S. mail, yeah, that's been an issue. I've been on two conference calls in the last week where the Deputy Postmaster General spoke to exactly those issues. So you're right to raise it. His point was that they have 600,000 workers. I never knew it was that many. 600,000 in the U.S. Postal Service. And right now, as of a few days ago, the illness rate, and that's now, that could totally change, of course, was very, very low, and they don't think it's going to impact service. We don't know. He could be wrong. He could be looking through rose-colored glasses. But right now, it's not a problem. The other question that secretaries of state and others asked, and this is related to your question, Representative, is can you handle it all? If a lot of states, not just Minnesota and not just the five that do it now, but if, you know, 20, 30, 40 states go this way, can the mail handle it? And he sort of chuckled on both calls, and he said, it's nothing compared to Christmas. He said, we handle Christmas. And he said, even if every state went to vote by mail, it would pale in comparison to what we have to prepare for the Christmas season. So as long as the workforce stays healthy, and it is so, it is now, he says it would not be a problem in terms of the load, in terms of the volume. That they could handle it. That was the Deputy Postmaster General. So I'm just conveying what he has said.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Go ahead, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, again, on the same line of questioning with the next step on this, you had indicated that individuals who are filing affidavits or candidacy could use an electronic signature. As you well know, the state has been grappling with broadband funding and the like, and the reliability of those services are not uniformly at a level that's acceptable across the entire state. So how do we deal with those individuals, or if we're not going to have the city hall open for someone to go to, or an auditor's office, or for a legislative candidate to be able to go to? And then finally, if we're going to have limited polling places, are we going to allow same-day registration that day as well? If I could just get answers to those two questions, Mr. Chair. Sure.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. As to the first question about polling places, I'm sorry, I was just thinking about that. Let me ask the second one first. Same day voter registration, yes, that's in statute. That would still be available. After all, you have to send the ballots out at some point. You have to have some cutoff for when you send them out. And there may be people who aren't eligible yet and suddenly became eligible, and you want to accommodate those in state law. Your first question was on the polling places. Can you remind me again? I'm sorry.
Mr. Secretary, I believe it was related to the affidavit candidacy and the issue of broadband and not equal access to the internet statewide.
Right. Well, the way we tried to craft the provision was it wouldn't be one size fits all, but it would be available to folks, just like it is now for the rule right now is for anybody filing for office who's out of the state for the entire filing period, has to be the whole filing period, they can use this now. So it's optional. So if someone had difficulty figuring it out, they could do it in person, they could mail it in, just giving them some other opportunities so that all of you on this committee and your opponents, I suppose, wouldn't have to necessarily go somewhere if they didn't have to. It's a fair question, but at least this is giving folks a tool or an option so that they if they had the opportunity, they wouldn't have to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I believe now I see that, he's disappeared. Representative Nash is raised his hand, and I'm trying to, you are unmuted. So, Representative Nash, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Secretary, thanks for the conversation that we had earlier. And I believe I was one of the ones you referenced as being opposed to your proposal. I really want to talk about how do we utilize our current no excuse absentee and in-person absentee. I had suggested at the time that we look at the option of expanding the number of municipal locations using some of the clerks that are there, creating an opportunity to put them behind some sort of plexiglass or a window or something like that. And you said that you would chew on that, and I wanted to get your take on that because, again, I am diametrically opposed to the language that we've got before us, and want to make sure that we're working towards that bipartisan solution that the House leadership, Senate leadership has also put out there is going to be required to move forward on things. So I just wanted to ask. First, where you are on the suggestion that I made on our call when you reached out.
Yep.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, thank you. And I was referring to you and others. You've been very straightforward, no hiding the ball here. And I appreciate that always. So I assume what you're talking about is vote by mail. I don't know if you've yet said that you oppose things, the other things we're talking about, you know, being able to file not in person or allowing the third parties or the non-major parties to submit electronic signatures and the like. But as long as we're talking about vote by mail, yeah, I'd be interested in hearing the testimony of the folks we have here, the elections administrators. I mean, there would be tremendous cost in ramping up more polling places. As you know, the unit of polling place is the precinct. So if we're now saying that each precinct will have maybe more than one, maybe you double it. If you don't double it, if you just say, well, in certain precincts, then you get into fights about, well, wait, this neighborhood got an extra one and that neighborhood didn't. And then you have lawsuits, I'm not kidding, about is there a disparate impact on particular communities because an election administrator decided to ramp up in one area, not another. So I guess the fairest way would just be to say, just theoretically, every precinct regardless gets two. So there's no picking and choosing. There's no playing favorites. That would be a cost. My concern there is where are you going to get the election judges? I mean, I'm concerned about 30,000 as it is. If we're in a crisis, we don't know if we will be, but if we are, I'm very concerned about the 30,000 we have now. I really would defer to the elections administrators to talk about what they see on the front lines and whether they think that is workable. I'm just personally concerned about election judges having people bail like they did in Wisconsin, having the opposite effect, even though we intend to have more polling places, actually having far fewer because election judges quit. And in some sense, who can blame them? At least yesterday in Wisconsin, I'm not saying generally speaking. The other thing I just would say, Representative and members, is I talked to an expert last week, and it's one guy, and experts are often wrong. So take it for what it's worth. And I asked him, you know, if we really did a public push and we said, hey, Minnesotans, we've got no excuses absentee. You do have to apply, but you can go online here or you can go to call this phone number. You know, what do you think we could do? And his view, one person's view, maybe he's being pessimistic and just doesn't know Minnesota like we do. He said, I think if you doubled it from 24%, which we have now, to 48% or 50%, his view was that was a grand slam home run. Now that doesn't mean, you know, we're a state that likes to overachieve and maybe we could get to 60 or we 70. I don't know. I don't want to hem us in or be negative about it, but let's say he's right. Let's say we get to 50%. That's still 1.5 million voters, in 30,000 polling places, if you can get the election judges. So you can see the math issue here. I guess that's my concern is finding the election judges, but maybe the elections administrators might chime in and say, no, I'm being too pessimistic, and they think they can find folks.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. And we're gonna be moving to their testimonies in a couple moments. So I'll see if Representative Nash has a quick follow-up. And then I have one more committee member, Representative Halverson, who's raised her hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Secretary, you know, you alluded to some of the potential cost issues around no-fault absentee. You know, we do have the HAVA money, and you could use that to begin pushing that out to people. Again, I'm not on board with the way the bill reads. I'm not going to be on board with the way the bill reads. And we need to, I think, begin having an earnest conversation about ways to either look at additional polling places or, you know, find a way to, within city halls, create these, much like I have here in my own city, and I know exist in other cities. I have concerns. I know we have to get this done, but please know that, you know, I am going on the presumption that the admonition from leadership is that we have to have these be bipartisan, and I'm gonna stick to that need to be bipartisan. I don't think that you're gonna find a lot of support coming out of the GOP for this. So let's begin having conversations about ways to, you know, expand polling places or do that with municipalities or county windows or whatever, and then to use whatever means we can to drive up the adoption rate of the no-fault absentee. But you've got my number, and I'm happy to work with you and all committee members, but I cannot abide by the way the bill's written, and I just appreciate the conversation that I know we'll be having.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Simon, Secretary Simon, we have a couple more individuals, so I want to get to them. I just want to also clarify a comment by Representative Nash. I think the agreement was through April 14th that we have to have complete buy-in from all leaders. So ultimately, I think that there will come a time where we'll be able to continue to debate this. My hope, and I think lots of people's hope, is we can come to some agreement prior to what's going to be a pretty important date, and that is the May 4th, because that's when vendors have to be brought on board. So,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nash.
Does that mean that after the 14th, we go back to being partisan or on these issues, or what is your interpretation of that?
Well, Representative Nash, I think that my interpretation, we go back to conducting business as has been in the past. I'm well aware, and I think most members are well aware, that there's currently a Republican majority in the Senate. So ultimately, any legislation regarding elections that would have to make it to the governor's desk for signature would also have to pass in the Senate. So I think there will have to be some bipartisan agreement on where we end up, but I'm not 100% sure that, you know, legislation may be considered within one or the other chamber that may not have bipartisan support at the time.
Well, and Mr. Chair, just briefly.
Representative,
you and I had, you and I had a conversation the other day, and you yourself admitted that to me on the call that the way the bill sits today does enable for heavy electioneering. And that's, again, something that we want to avoid. And because of that, and because of the conversation that you and I had and the conversation the secretary and I had, that is why we can't support this, because it's going to provide for a lot of electioneering. And, you know, it does open the door for elections fraud. We talked about that. You agreed that points were well made, and you did agree that electioneering is a very distinct possibility as a result of this. And that's why we're going to be strident in making sure that this does not move forward like this. So, well, just wanted to make sure, put that on record.
Thank you, Representative Nash. I don't believe I used the word heavy electioneering. I think I used the word possible electioneering, and that's why I requested that you might come forward with some other methods to try to assure that electioneering could be, mitigated, the possibility of that. And I think in order to really understand that, we'll begin to have conversations about what that might mean, how that might happen, and what are the things we can do to prevent it from happening. So I think, you know, every election there's opportunities for voter fraud. Every election there's opportunity for electioneering. So I think moving to a absentee ballot to all Minnesota registered voters does not change the possibility of those happening beyond what that currently exists. But I know that we'll continue to have conversations over the next few weeks. I know that Secretary Simon has put together a task force, and we'll continue to have these conversations. And my hope, and I think everybody's hope, is that we come to some agreement by May 4th so we can move forward as possible. With that, I'm going to move to a question by Representative Halverson, and then we have Representative New and O'Driscoll, who also would like to make a comment or a question. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And two things I'd like to say in regard to the previous conversation is, one, yeah, it's important that we do a lot of bipartisan work now and when we're not in a pandemic in order to make sure that our voters get to have their voices heard at the polls. That is the priority. And our job here is to make sure that we're representing the voices of the people of Minnesota and what they want to see happen with regard to their elections. One of the pleasant surprises I've seen as a candidate over the past few years with the expansion of no excuses absentee balloting in Minnesota is that Minnesotans really like mail-in balloting options, because Minnesotans tend to be very informed voters. And what I have heard from voters at the doors is that they get to sit with their ballots at their computers and do research on candidates. And it shows with the fact that Minnesota has such high voter turnout how engaged our population is. And so we owe it to them to do everything possible and explore every possible opportunity to ensure the enfranchisement of the citizens of Minnesota. And that is what we are here doing today. And so I want to thank the secretary for being here. There's been some allusion at the national level and here in this conversation that somehow mail-in balloting is not secure. Knowing that a lot of Minnesotans choose mail-in balloting, either direct mail balloting that their precincts require, or that they choose it through absentee means, I'm wondering if the secretary can talk about the security of mail-in balloting and how that works.
Mr. Secretary, briefly, if you can.
Yeah. Sure. Thank you, Representative Halverson and members and Mr. Chair. I just want to make a distinction here. Sometimes there's less here than meets the eye. It's the same security features that we have for not only for the 130,000 people that already live under the system, but for everyone in terms of security. One of the things that we have, and I'm not sure, maybe different people mean different things when they talk about electioneering. I'm not sure what people mean by that term. But if what they mean is somebody harvesting ballots, somebody saying, hey, going around a neighborhood and saying, hey, I'm on my way to the post office. Can you just throw it in my giant satchel here and I'll deliver them for you? You may know that in North Carolina, they had to have a do-over in a congressional election a few months ago because of allegations of ballot harvesting. We have a law in Minnesota that limits to 3 the number of ballots that any person can return. And there's a lawsuit about that right now by folks who want to overturn that law, and we are defending that law. So we have a 3-person limit right now. So I'm not sure if that's what's meant by electioneering, but I just want to use this opportunity to say to members, the only difference between what the 130,000 people already enjoy in many of your districts and absentee voting is an additional layer of bureaucracy. One of the lessons from yesterday in Wisconsin was that local elections officials were literally overwhelmed by all the absentee ballot application requests. Just handling that mail, that's an extra wave of mail. And even when you go online, it's not a robot, it's not a computer, you're submitting it online, but a real human being has to actually process that on the other end. It's not automatic, it's just the way that you're transmitting it. So it's a tremendous burden to ask people to the tune of 50%, 60%, 70% to process those ballots. So that's the only difference. And that's the only difference in terms of security as well. It's the same security that we enjoy across the board.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. I'm going to now move to Representative O'Driscoll and then Representative New, and the brevity is going to be encouraged. Representative O'Driscoll. Your audio is not on at the moment. Let me see. Here you go, Representative O'Driscoll.
Very good. Mr. Chair, very quick follow-up to a comment that Representative Halverson made. I don't think that anybody is really challenging the idea about the concept that we currently have under mail-in ballots. When we go out and we advertise and we promote to everyone across the state of Minnesota that ballots for all voters will be in the mailbox, that's where nefarious activity could begin to increase in the process when everyone has that option, because it will be in everyone's mailbox. And so I want to just kind of balance that comment back just a little bit in thinking that when we do the current system, no one knows for sure who requested those ballots. This is, as the Secretary has admitted, going off to every registered voter. So we have a higher potential for nefarious activity. Just wanted to offer that. Not a question, a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the comment, Representative O'Driscoll. And now Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, I just have a clarifying question to start. In your opening remarks, you had mentioned that this would apply to the period during a peacetime emergency or immediately following the peacetime emergency. I don't see that in the bill language, and I'm wondering if I'm not looking at the most current version or if I missed an amendment. All I see is that it applies during the peacetime emergency. There's nothing indicating immediately following.
Secretary Simon, or is Matt Gearing available? Secretary Simon, do you want to attempt to handle it?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Maybe we should turn to Mr. Gearing. I actually don't have, I have an older version of the bill in front of me, unfortunately. So that's certainly our intention. But if it's not in the bill, it ought to be.
Okay, Mr. Gearing, would you like to speak to it?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Yep. So, Mr. Chair, if you look at subdivision 4 of section 1 of the bill on line 2.20, it says that the order is issued by the Secretary on or after May 1st of an even-numbered year that apply to the state primary or general are not revocable and would apply regardless of whether the peacetime emergency remains in effect. So the Secretary is only authorized in this bill to issue orders during the period of an emergency, but if the emergency is ended and he's already issued the orders for the coming fall election after May 1st, then those orders would remain in place even if the emergency is technically done.
Representative New, did that answer your question?
That did, thank you. So my My questions then are, well, I've got a couple. I also on the amendment, on the A3 amendment, the 14 days prior to the date of an election, I have some concerns about that. And I'm wondering if we currently have an issue that with early voting, folks are only able to retrieve a ballot 7 days prior to an election. So to clarify, this would mean that folks are locked in now 14 days prior to the election, correct?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative New, yeah, that's correct. That is the trade-off. But all the election administrators are saying, you can see the anxiety and almost panic in their voices and faces. They cannot process the kind of volume of mail in 7 days. They just can't do it. They just cannot do it. They need extra time. That period used to be 4 days. A few years ago, we moved it to 7 days. They're saying they need an extra week just to process the massive volumes of mail. I hope you'll hear from them directly today. And I just want to say, Mr. Chair, very briefly, since I don't know when I'll have the microphone next, the argument that someone's going to raid mailboxes because they'll know ballots are out there, you could say that in the 130,000 where you know for a fact that everybody in that jurisdiction, everybody on a certain day or within a couple of days will have ballots in their mailboxes. You could say that about your stimulus check. You could say that about tax documents. So if this is really about mailbox raiding, I mean, we're going to have a witness requirement, just like we do right now in state law. And at some point, you got to make the public health calculation here. Are a couple of dumb people going to raid a mailbox? Sure, they could do that now. They could do that with absentee balloting. And if what I'm hearing is we should really, really rally the troops to get absentee balloting up to that number, doesn't that argument apply? If we do a really successful PR campaign and we get 70% of Minnesotans to vote this way, there's a 7 in 10 chance, right, that someone's going to go to a mailbox and find a ballot that they can monkey around with. So I'm hearing a little bit of a mixed message that you don't want stuff in mailboxes, yet you do want us to push people to order stuff that comes to their mailbox. I don't see the distinction between what happens on the 130,000 and asking someone to do another layer of bureaucracy by asking for it when in 130,000 people's worth of jurisdictions, they don't have to ask for it. So I'm getting mixed messages. Should we push people to order stuff that comes to their mailbox and thereby reduce that ratio or not? And does it matter whether it comes to their mailbox automatically, or does it matter that they have to do something and request it? Does it matter to that issue, I should say? Is mailbox raiding less an issue because the thing that landed in the mailbox came as the result of someone's request or automatically? I don't think there's a difference there.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary and Representative New. We do have a couple election officials to get to in next testimony. So I'll let you ask your last question so we can get them. So please proceed.
Although I'd like to point out that I did not get most of my time here, so that was unrelated to my questions. My next question would be, I have some concern about the timelines. By all accounts, this is slowing right now and things are trending in the right direction. And yet this will be issued on May 1st to apply to the election that will be taking place 6 months later. And so I guess I would ask Secretary Simon if you'd be willing to walk us through a little bit of what the timeline looks like. What are those drop dead dates for this process and this programming?
Sure. Mr. Secretary.
And I'll try to be quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New. Yeah, so May 4th, the one that Chair Dean referenced, there's a major vendor in Minnesota, I won't name the company, that does a lot of national work, but a lot of work for many counties and cities in Minnesota in terms of ballot and envelope printing. It's the envelopes that are really key here. And they have told us that May 4th is the deadline that they need to figure out for the primary, not necessarily the general yet, what they need to do to retool in terms of their facility and all the rest. Then there are other statutory deadlines. We have to provide training to all the county auditors. We're figuring out a way to do it remotely this year. That has to happen in the month of May. And if we train them for System A and we end up doing System B, does that mean we have to redo the training? Does it not? Can we substitute it some other way? Then there's the absentee ballot period. That begins June 26th. We are now, I forget the math now, I think we're 80, 79 days away, something like that from there. And so this is the kind of thing that, I mean, it's a tired cliche, but I'll use it. It's like turning an aircraft carrier. You can't do it easily. So if we say as of May 1st or any date for that matter, okay, we're going with system A, we can't flip a switch weeks or months in and say, no, we don't need system A yet anymore. We're going to system B. That's the general idea. But for more specifics, I would defer to David Maeda from our office or the elections administrators that you'll hear from. That's the general picture.
Okay, and Representative New, I'll give you one more quick question, then we're going to move into our other testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So really what you're saying is that for either of these elections, you really need that 3-month lead-in. That's approximately what it would be from May to the August primary, right? So it feels very premature to make a decision May 1st for the November election when things look very differently. It seems like we might want to break those things out. Excellent. I will wait to hear from the other testifiers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Secretary, can you speak real briefly to the comment about three months versus 6 months?
Mr. Chair and Representative New, I think that roughly speaking, yes, and we would certainly need 3 months. The problem, of course, is that the legislature is going to be out of session. And unless the governor decides to call you all back for this purpose or other purposes, I mean, there's no guarantee of that. And I have not spoken to the governor or anyone in the governor's office about that prospect or that possibility. So we're hearing from the counties and the cities that they would like to know what the system is going to be for both, for ease of use, for their own internal training, for their own budgets, for their own staffing. So they're saying that they would really like to know in one fell swoop, are we adopting system A or not? Doing a hybrid comes with some risks. Again, if we wait to do something for November, the legislature is not going to be in town, at least not in a regular session.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I'm going to move into our election officials now. So if Debbie Erickson is available, you have I hate to do this, but you know, you've got about 3 or 4 minutes now instead of 5.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will try to keep everything as brief as possible. My name is Debbie Erickson. I'm the Administrative Services Director in Crow Wing County, and I also serve as the Chair of the Elections Committee for the Minnesota Association of County Officers. I did submit a letter to you that you should have with your materials with regard to MACO's position in support of this action. And I just want to highlight a couple of additional things that have been discussed already this morning in addition to my letter. One of the things that we want to look at and we have concerns at as election administrators is polling places and election judge availability. As it's been stated, there are several polling places that are serving voters in residential facilities, in nursing homes. In addition, there are schools, churches, those types of buildings that are right now closed to the general public and right now are a concern of finding available spaces to be able to hold elections come August or November. Additionally, along with that is many of these polling places are quite small. If you think of the rural town hall, that's a one-room location that has enough room for election judges to be set up and for the voters to come in. If we're talking in August and voters are having to wait in line like they were 10 feet apart in Wisconsin yesterday, where we saw lines going around the block and down the street a couple significant portions, August is one thing. If we're looking into November, Minnesota weather in November with voters having to keep distance outside of not being able to go into a polling place is also a concern that we have to think of for our voters. Many of these places don't have enough parking facilities to accommodate people having to wait a significant number of minutes or hours in some cases in order to be allowed into the polling place one at a time or two at a time. Our election judges are another concern that we have as administrators. One of the things being that a significant portion of our judges are at an at-risk population, and we already have difficulty in finding enough election judges to staff the 3,000 polling places plus across the state. I did hear someone mention that the potential of adding additional polling places to help spread out the number of people who are going to be in each polling location could be an issue or could be an option. I don't really see that this could be something that would be a doable solution. Finding locations, number one, and the people to staff them. Right now, statute says that you have to have at least 4 election judges for a polling place that is operating under off-scan voting, which is what we have here in Minnesota. Finding that volume of additional election judges to expand the number of polling places and provide the supplies, materials, and equipment that would be needed in those circumstances would be quite difficult. Rather, MACO is supportive of the idea of a mail ballot process that also employs vote centers. Because you're correct, there are some voters who choose not to vote by mail or who are not comfortable or able to vote through the mail process. We do think it's important that there still be options for people to vote in person. Vote centers, which would give opportunities for voters to come to one location or multiple locations in a jurisdiction, but could handle more than one precinct in those locations, would be a way that we could help to see that that would serve that population as well. One of the things also, as far as timelines go, right now we are working towards the August and November election cycle and still finishing from the presidential nomination primary cycle that we just completed in March. We are required to train election judges usually in that June to July timeframe for the August and November elections. And as was stated earlier, we need to know what processes would be trained for those election judges. We're already looking at ways that we can conduct our training of election judges exclusively remotely. Right now, we do have some counties who have employed that opportunity in the past. It's rather new, and some of our counties haven't done that yet, but they are looking at ways that they can get those judges trained without having to have those in-person opportunities. Finally, the other thing that I wanted to kind of just make a note of is the fact that voters who are currently voting through the all-mail process, many of them have been doing this since 1996, since 1998. We do continue to see some of these precincts that are smaller in nature, sometimes more rural in nature, that choose to vote exclusively by mail. There are some voters in those precincts who you will hear from that do enjoy that opportunity and others who do not enjoy that opportunity. One of the things that we would suggest is that having the vote centers gives that flexibility. They do have the opportunity to make sure that they are tracking their mail ballot as well. There is an online service that any voter, whether they vote by absentee ballot or by mail ballot, can track what the status of their ballot is from the standpoint of if it's been sent, if it's been received back by the county offices, and if it's been accepted or processed through that system. If we were to go simply to a system that required every voter to request an absentee ballot through our No Excuses absentee process, that increases the number of touch points on each ballot from 6 touch points for a mail ballot to 8 to 10 or more touch points. Also would put an extreme strain on the statewide voter registration system, which is currently doing its best to support the No Excuses absentee model that we currently have. But we have seen some significant slowdowns and issues with that system in the past elections. And we have some strong concerns that requiring additional people to apply for and have to utilize that system would again cause some very massive problems with that system operating as it should. I'll leave my comments at that for now, but would be open to any questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. I have one quick question, I believe, from Representative Halverson before we move on to our next testifier, Jenny Gelms. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Ms. Erickson did touch on what I was going to ask about, and that was about the differences between a mail-in system versus the current absentee system and what impact it has on our local counties and what impact it has on the statewide voter registration database. I want to emphasize that our counties are being strained right now in many ways. Local public health has been called into intense action. Services are being called into intense action as families are needing services. And so I want to be really get real clarification about how this impacts counties kind of across the board. This is one more example of how we could really be straining our counties and local units of government at a time when they are already stretched and at a time when resources are becoming more scarce. And so I just wanted to hear Ms. Erickson perhaps comment on that.
Ms. Erickson, if you could be brief, we've got a hard quit time of 11:15, and I see we still have three, possibly four testifiers yet. So please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, there would be additional work that would be required at the county levels to administer mail balloting, no doubt. However, there is also services available to assist with that process that are not available for the no excuse absentee. There are vendors across the state who can assist with original mailings. Right now, those of us who have mail ballot precincts in our counties, we have vendors that send that initial mailing of those ballots out to that first wave, if you will, all voters who are registered. It takes that whole touch point of having to process the application and do the envelope stuffing and sending those ballots out from that local level. So it does give us opportunities to outsource when it's for the full registered voter population versus each one on an individual basis.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. We'll now move on to Jenny Gelms from Hennepin County.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jenny Gelms. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. We can't see you, okay. But we hear you just fine.
Okay, thank you. I am the elections manager for Hennepin County. I've been working with my elections team and my county and city elections manager in the elections managers in the metro area and across the state in the last month. I have heard great concern over how we could successfully serve our voters in the upcoming August primary and November general election under the current circumstances. Election staff and election judges and seasonal workers are concerned about their own health and safety as well as that of their voters. We're struggling to plan how we could possibly deliver voting services as we currently do in a situation where the recommended practice is for people to remain 6 feet away from each other and avoid sharing materials that others have recently touched. My opinion and the strong consensus of the county and city elections officials I've spoken with is that mail balloting elections are needed during this crisis in order to successfully administer elections under these circumstances. We're fortunate to already have mail balloting procedures existing in Minnesota election law. And our belief is that if these procedures are good enough for the smaller jurisdictions in greater Minnesota, then they are good enough for larger metro area jurisdictions during this crisis. Using mail balloting in combination with a limited number of in-person polling places will enable us to avoid asking most election judges, many of whom, due to age or underlying medical conditions, are in a high-risk group. Over half of the election judges in Hennepin County are over the age of 60. I'm extremely concerned at the vast number of election judges who would opt not to serve during this crisis, even if we did provide personal protective equipment and plexiglass. So using the mail balloting option would enable us to avoid asking those people to serve and asking our voters to congregate in polling places in order to exercise their right to vote. Seeing lines extending for blocks and blocks outside of Wisconsin polling places yesterday to accommodate social distancing gave me literal chills as I imagine such scenes in Minnesota in November. As to the question of whether existing absentee voting law is enough to enable us to reduce crowds in polling places, I would respectfully offer that that would not be enough. In Hennepin County in 2016 and 2018, 30% of voters cast absentee ballots. Even if we were wildly successful in campaigning to encourage voters to voluntarily vote that way, and we saw a doubling of that amount, we still could not successfully reduce the need for polling places to a level that could be safely and adequately staffed. Additionally, approximately 30% of absentee voting administration time is spent on processing applications and preparing the daily mailings. So mail balloting eliminates the application process and the ballot mail out can be consolidated and automated, and that efficiency would be crucial to our ability to timely process the increased volume of voting through the mail while still maintaining social distancing for staff. As for increasing the number of polling places, I can't envision having the ability to staff the number of polling places we already have. Additionally, we do not have the voting equipment that would be required to increase the number of polling places. Lastly, regardless of whether mail balloting elections are authorized, we know that many more voters than usual will likely voluntarily choose to vote by mail. And so under either scenario, we have an absolutely crucial need to have additional time to open, process, and count these ballots. Current law gives us 7 days prior to election day. I believe we need at least 20 days prior to election day in order to handle that volume. In a high turnout mail ballot precincts in Minnesota, 2/3 of ballots are returned in the final 3 weeks before election day. 1/4 of them are returned the day before or on election day itself. That last batch of ballots is what leads us to believe we would also need 7 days after election day to complete the process of counting ballots. So creating a plan for Minnesota elections through the fall is urgent. even though none of us know what the status of the crisis will be by August or November, we do need a plan now that will enable us to successfully train our clerks and our election judges in order to conduct the elections under a scenario where social distancing is still a reality, and to be able to communicate with the public about how the elections will work. City clerk training occurs in May, election judge training begins in July, candidate filing opens in a few weeks. In order for us administrators to ensure a smooth process for all voters, we need a plan that we can work on implementing now that will help keep our voters and our workers safe. I would urge members to support MG 111-1, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Gelms. I think before questions, I think we're gonna get through our last testifiers, and then if we have time, there'll be time for members to ask questions. As I mentioned, we have a hard quit time at 11:15. So I'd like to move on now to Nick Harper from the Minnesota League of Women Voters. And Mr. Harper, if you could, you know, maybe keep your comments to 3.5-4 minutes, that would be great. Mr. Harper.
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nick Harper. I'm with the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. Obviously, we have extreme concern about how the COVID-19 crisis might affect our elections. As you know, as we've been discussing, early voting for the primary starts, absentee voting starts in June. So we need to be prepared for that. There's not an opportunity to wait and see or act later, because in order to prepare for voting to start in June, that work needs to begin for preparation as soon as possible. We saw yesterday in Wisconsin a lot of challenges that they encountered, and we can't have a repeat of that here in Minnesota. We saw voters waiting in rain for hours in order to get into their polling place. We saw that they had to call in the National Guard to assist them to execute their election process. We need to do everything we can to avoid that here in Minnesota. They did not have the policy plans in place or the resources to adequately address the issue, but Minnesota thankfully has the opportunity to do that. And this committee and the legislature can do that. We did send in some written materials with specific detailed policy proposals that we were already working on before this committee hearing was scheduled. So we've sent that in as part of our written materials. The policy proposals fall into three broad areas: maximizing our existing processes and just tweaking them for the COVID crisis specifically and temporarily, fortifying our polling places, because we will need to continue to have in-person polling places to assist voters with language assistance or disabilities, as well as handling same-day registrations, and we need to invest in resources in the election officials that are testifying today to ensure that the work can be done. Regarding that letter, we do have two co-signer organizations, the ARC of Minnesota and LEADA Men, who have signed on and co-signed. We'll get an updated letter with those signatories to the committee members. But this bill hits many of the policy proposals that we offered in our letter, we think that this bill is a good bill. We already do most of these proposals in some way, shape, or form, or another, and there's not really a good reason for us to avoid using the tools we already have in our toolbox and just simply authorizing them to be used in this emergency temporarily. I know that there's been concerns addressed today about ballots potentially being taken out of mailboxes, but to be perfectly frank, in terms of protecting voting under the law, protecting absentee and mail balloting in some ways might be protected greater by the law than in-person voting, because there's also additional mail theft and mail tampering and mail fraud statutes that could apply both at the state level and federal level. So potentially there is more legal protections for mail and absentee ballot voting by mail for voters to ensure that those ballots remain safe. And this body has rightfully, wisely, prudently granted itself a temporary privilege of voting from home in order to protect its loved ones and themselves from the COVID-19 crisis and disease. We're simply asking that you offer that same temporary privilege to your constituents to protect themselves and their loved ones as well. If members have any questions about the content of our letter or my testimony, I'm happy to take questions, but I understand that we're on a short timeline, so I'll end my testimony there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harper. We're now going to move to Ms. Sanders. Ms. Sanders, I believe you're unmuted. If you can sum up what you need to say in about 2-3 minutes, we would love you even more.
Okay. This is Judy Sanders, and I'm speaking on behalf of the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota. And I want to begin by thanking you. It started in this committee that in the House of Representatives this year, or you passed a bill which gave us access to a mail ballot. And we hope that whatever you decide to pass in however you wish to do it, that you'll include all that language and procedure that you had. You did better than the Senate. They didn't come through with that language for us, so this is their big chance. That's probably all that we need to say, except to remind you that before 2006, we weren't able to have privacy at the voting polls like you had. But now the technology exists for us to do it. So now it's got to be expanded so that when we vote by mail, whether it's because we requested an absentee ballot or because you decide you're going to mail to everybody, that we can do it, and we can do it privately and independently. We'll be happy voters.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Sanders. And we are now going to move to our last comment, Ms. Susan Shogren-Smith. If we could unmute her, I don't seem to have that capability. Ms. Smith, if you'd like to proceed. Okay. Amanda, anything? I'm not seeing anything on my screen that allows me to unmute her. Do we know if she's actually hooked into audio feed?
Representative Dean, I'm looking into it. I don't have the ability to unmute her either.
Okay. Well, as you're looking into it, we have exactly 7 minutes left. I'm sure we'll have some final comments. I don't know if we're going to have time for questions at this point from our testifiers, but what I do want to say is this is going to be an ongoing conversation in the next few weeks. So we will have other opportunities to inquire and hear from them and maybe even ask our questions to them directly. So I want to start moving to a few final comments. If members could keep their final comments to, less than 60 seconds, it'll allow us all to have some comments. So Representative Bernardi.
I think conversation in the next few weeks. So other opportunities to inquire and hear from them and maybe even ask our questions to them directly. So I want to start moving to a
few. I don't know what's happening.
If members have final comments to, less than 60 seconds, it'll allow us all to have some comments. So Representative Bernardi.
Well, I will try now, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Is this working? Okay, thank you so much. And Mr. Chair and Secretary of State Steve Simon, thank you so much for your leadership and being proactive to make sure we put the things in place that will ensure that our people can vote in our elections. And by doing nothing, it could cause voter suppression in a weird kind of way. And we want to make sure that we engage as many voters in our state as possible. And I just want to share with my city just communicated to me during this testifying today. And what they said was it's important to them, and I agree, that we keep our voters, our poll workers, and our staff safe. In New Brighton, they have election judges that are resigning now, and they're still months away from the election. In fact, so many have resigned out of COVID-19 concerns. We have five less election judges left per precinct. In a presidential election, we normally have about 15 election judges per precinct. So this is a huge issue, and I appreciate everybody coming together and working on a solution to keep people safe and to make sure our voters can vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. And before I move on to Representative Nash, I believe we've worked out the issue with Ms. Shogren-Smith. So if you would like to proceed, Ms. Smith, and if you can sum up your comments in 2 minutes, that would be great.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you now, so please proceed.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much. I will go quickly, and I will say that I am a member of the Republican Lawyers, although I'm not representing them today. I want to just say that as to the concerns about the number of available election judges, I do think that there should be some bipartisan agreement to move the date that the parties have to identify election judges from May to possibly late July or even early August as to the November election in response to all of the concerns, because I think there's no way to have a complete list by May 1st based on the current circumstances. I also think that as to a special session, I would think that voters in Minnesota would expect legislators to be willing to come together without any debate for a special session related to election issues. As Representative New noted, all indications are that by November, this crisis will hopefully not be a crisis anymore. We're going to have a lot more information. Unless we are not being told information about what's happening, many people in Minnesota will have already been exposed and probably have immunity. We have about almost 7 months to get to that point. So I think that it's very important that we are going to be all pushing to have testing for people to find out if they have developed antibodies to this virus, because that would eliminate a lot of concerns for many people. Finally, I think I would like to say comparisons to Wisconsin yesterday, they're not really helpful. There was incredibly short notice, and they are in the midst of a crisis, which is not going to be what's going to be happening in November. So we have a system that allows voters 45 days now to vote by mail early in person. People have the ability to do that, and certainly every Minnesota voter knows about the crisis that's happening today. So we do need to have an effective system of communication. Minnesota residents, I think, expect election officials to participate in the system of communication. I think that with all due respect to Representative Halverson, I don't think that everybody agrees we have a secure system of voting. I think there are a lot of questions in this process about the security of all ballots that are mailed in, about the verification of eligibility of the voter and witnesses, storage of ballots, movement of ballots from counties to precincts, or whatever the process could end up being, which I think we don't know. So I think there are a lot of issues. And as to the mandatory mail-in system being used by right now 130,000 voters, that is possibly 4% of voters using that system. The voters in those systems are from rural areas. Often the people in those towns know each other. They know who's voting. There's a totally different system than in the metro area where we have many more people moving about, et cetera. So I think that we can't really compare what's happening to 130,000 voters in 4% of the situations as opposed to these large metro urban areas. So, and I would also hope that the Secretary of State would be exploring possibly ending some of the issues related to voter purging in the courts and helping to build trust with those communities of people that do have a lot of concern about the Secretary of State's office. I feel like this bill that has been presented has done much to probably inflame the fears of those people who don't trust the Secretary of State's office. And I think that we have to be very aware of that. So that's it. That's what, and sorry, it was not a lot of notice to get ready. So, but you guys are doing a great job and I appreciate everything you're doing.
Well, I want to thank you, Ms. Smith. And you know, you referenced the issue around public health and the current status of the pandemic. And many public health officials have said there's a possibility of a second wave that may come through this coming fall. So I think we need to be prepared and considerate of all those things. And we're down to our final minute. So it looks like you get the final word, Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And for those who were here, I just want to make sure that you know that as the Republican lead on this committee, and I'm ready to work with you and to help, but that I still don't view that this is the proper solution. Our Minnesota voters are afforded a way to vote by absentee balloting today. I would like to, if we do nothing else, look at how do we expand that. But just know that This is a long way from where we're going to be comfortable. We're not going to be supportive of this, and that I would hope that we would all be willing to roll up our sleeves, work together to look at a way that we're going to have that bipartisan support that we've referenced, so that we can avoid some of the problems that we have articulated. And I will say, as to the last testifier, there's a lot of concern. And Mr. Secretary, there is a ton of concern with this proposal. And I agree that this has gone to inflame the fears of people who are looking at this proposal. And, you know, there has to be a better way than this. And you have my commitment to work with you, but this is not something that is going to be supported. So appreciate our time here today. And to the chair and the secretary and everybody on the committee, just know that we're here ready to work. But there's a long, long, long way from being something that we support.
Well, thank you, Representative Nash. And I want to thank all the testifiers, all the members, and of course, all the staff that have worked very, very hard to make this happen. We are 1 minute over, so we are in trouble. So I am going to conclude this meeting. Reminder, we do not have a bill before us. We have proposed language, and at some point we will have a bill before this committee, and we will begin the voting and deliberation at that time. So thanks to you, everybody. Have a wonderful afternoon, and if as we go on our break, hopefully you'll have a enjoyable weekend, and hopefully the sun will be out so we can at least get outside in our yards and see the sun. So thank you, everybody.